How many of you have come across the language of time management? I don't know at what point in the last few years this has come into vogue, so it might be that those of you who are retired remember well this kind of talk from when you were there, or whether it's just a relatively new thing. But time management is a set of techniques to help you order and choose how to spend your time. And so we can all imagine this, whether it's in our working life or in any other type of life. You're landed with a request to do something. Something pops up in your inbox. Would you please dot, dot, dot? And then so the question goes, well, this isn't in itself a bad thing to do, but what do I drop in order to get this one done? I wonder how many of you have an organisation slot at the beginning of your week, or the beginning of each day perhaps, where you just look over what's coming up and what you need to be ready for and what you need to remember. What are the things that can be interrupted? What are the things that I cannot get to the end of the week without having done? And what are the things that actually I'll do if I get some space, but otherwise I'm happy to drop them? So the two basic decisions, as far as I can work out, are to choose between that which is important and unimportant, and also between that which is urgent and non-urgent. And so we order our lives in this kind of way, I think, and we often find it really easy to pay more attention to that which is presented to us as urgent, sometimes I find anyway, than what's necessarily important. Now the reason I say all this is because when we come to meet the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, we are finding that we meet a God who does not work on our own terms. We find a God who will not have our own agendas and urgencies imposed on him. And if you're a person who prays, then you will know all too well how difficult it can be when God doesn't seem to be answering your prayers with the same urgency that you pray them. So sometimes we offer up our most desperate and hurried or our most fragile prayers to God. God, I know that you can heal this person. God, I know that you can bring this person to faith in you. God, I know that you can intervene. And almost always, we find that God answers our prayers in a different way or on a different time scale than we expect. If you've ever experienced particular grief or tragedy, you'll know that very, very well for yourself. You know it more generally as well, I'm sure. And the reason for that is when we meet the God of the Bible, we're not meeting a cosmic slot machine. We're not meeting a being for whom where we just need to press the right buttons and the answer we want will pop out. And we find, as we have been doing, as we've read Luke's Gospel over these last few weeks, that this God is personal. And this God is as personal with us as it is possible to be. Luke writes his Gospel to tell us who Jesus is. And he tells us what it's like to be with him. Luke writes his Gospel because he wants us to see the same things in Jesus that caused so many people who met and spoke to Jesus and saw him in the flesh around 2,000 years ago, that made them give up everything in their lives for the sake of going to follow him. So let's meet this morning a surprising personal God. Let's meet the one who has power over sickness and death. And let's turn to page 1038 of our Bibles, if we'd like to, and meet Jesus on page 1038 of our pew Bibles. This story Luke put together from eyewitness accounts. So this starts off with a homecoming. Jesus returns to Galilee. That's the place he'd been working out of. And he sees a large crowd who are waiting and hurried to meet him. And I suspect that the reason the large crowd has gathered there is partly because they're excited about Jesus, but partly because they know that Jairus is there with a request. Jairus, in verse 41 we see, enter Jairus, the synagogue leader. Jairus is respected. He's a part of the religious establishment. He's a local religious leader. And he's at least moderately wealthy. Jairus is someone who's really impressive. Jairus is the kind of person, if you were trying to start a movement about God in a place, Jairus is the kind of person you would want on your side. And notice that Jairus, every piece of decorum he has falls aside instantly when the well-being of his little girl is at stake. Jairus literally comes to Jesus on his knees. He's pleading. He's convulsed with fear and grief. Desperate and naked before Jesus. Now, if you're one of Jesus' disciples, I wonder at this moment, you might be thinking, this is a real opportunity. This man is rich, he's powerful, he's a part of the local religious establishment. If Jesus can heal his daughter, then that can only be good for the project. That can only be good for our PR and our connections. If we heal the synagogue leader's daughter, then this is going to take us to exciting places. And so Jesus puts on the blue lights, as it were, and starts walking towards Jairus' house, ready for this headline hometown miracle. This is going to be fantastic, thinks the disciples. We're going to get to see just how powerful Jesus is. And everyone, including Jairus, is going to notice. And so we imagine then this large group of people crowded in tightly around Jesus. The blue lights are on. The miracle is coming. Who touched me? It wasn't for Jesus' question, we'd have missed her, wouldn't we? We learn in the other Gospels that this woman had spent all of her money on doctors over the years. So she was poor, she'd spent everything she had, and she hadn't been able to stop her bleeding. So this woman had had 12 years of blending into the background, 12 years of passing through as unnoticed as she possibly could be. 12 years of not being allowed to live a public life, 12 years of living death, ceremonially unclean. It's that kind of long-term, low-grade shame that sits deep and pervades absolutely everything about her. This woman, for 12 years, had experienced what it was like to be a non-person. And so you don't blame her at all, do you? She reaches out a desperate hand in the midst of this scrum of people moving down towards Jairus' house. As she does it, she knows she's breaking the law. She knows that because she's ceremonially unclean, she shouldn't touch anybody, let alone a holy man. But just like Jairus, what chance does she have? And she knows that she's healed instantly the moment she touches Jesus. She just reaches out. And I like to think it's this really slight brush of the edge of his garment. She thinks, great, I can slide away. But Jesus wants this to be personal. Can you see how much Jesus doesn't just want to say, well, great, I've done that. He feels the power going out of him, and Jesus is absolutely determined. This is a personal interaction with him. Who touched me? The disciples say, Jesus, are you crazy? So it's like a rugby scrum here. There's hundreds of people pressing into you. You can barely breathe. What do you mean, who touched you? But Jesus knew that this was a very particular kind of touch. And the woman is terrified at this point because she fears that the game is up. She had no legal right to touch Jesus at this point. Jesus could have turned round and got her in a lot of trouble. She fears the worst. She falls at his feet in desperation, the second person to do so that day. And yet in front of everybody, in front of Jesus, she spills everything. She tells her story. That's the act of faith, I think, for this woman. It's not the superstitious touch of a miracle worker. It's not like, there's this guy who does miracles, if I can just touch him. Jesus wants so much more than that. Jesus wants to restore her. Daughter, your faith has healed you. Go in peace. You're publicly restored. And now, because of Jesus stopped, you belong to me. You're mine. One writer I read about this week said, there's all the difference in the world between a superstitious person who gets a bodily healing and a life-transformed follower of Jesus for all eternity. But one of those interactions takes a lot more time than the other. So imagine Jairus in the midst of this conversation. How do you think Jairus is feeling? If there was ever an example of something that was important and non-urgent, surely it was this woman who'd been ill for 12 years. She could have waited another hour. But this girl, on the other hand, this is a blue light emergency situation. One of these cases is straight out of Casualty. The other one is straight out of Dr. Martin, isn't it? No sane doctor would stop to have a counselling session with a woman who had a long-term illness while there was a little girl who was literally dying just round the corner. Lives are at stake here. Notice as well how Jesus turns the social order on its head. A man, a synagogue leader, a rich, important person. He is in this life or death situation with his daughter. And this woman here, who is at the very, very opposite end of the social scale, Jesus stops and has an interaction with her as well. Just another example of how the Bible turns all these sorts of things upside down. But Jesus isn't working on anybody else's timescale. So as Jesus has this conversation with this woman, comes the sucker punch. Comes the hit to the guts. Too late, Jesus. She's dead. You didn't make it. And let's imagine we're there at the moment. Who on earth can say to a grieving father at that moment, don't be afraid, only believe, and she will be healed? Who can do that? Who can say that to someone whose whole life has just blown up around him? Some unimaginable way that Jesus wants to tell her, you know, don't be afraid, it'll all come out in the wash. These things happen. He looks at Jairus and says, I want you to trust me. And so Jesus goes into the house. By this point, all the mourners have come. They're professional mourners at this time of in history. So in the Middle East in those times, if someone died, you would have mourners who would come, who would do all the wailing and grieving around you and outside your house. The people, I suspect, are still there waiting to see what happens. And instead, Jesus goes in just with the parents and just with Peter, John, and James. And he says, stop it. Stop the wailing. Stop the mourning. She's asleep. This time they laugh at him. Again, who on earth can do that? Who on earth can step into a morgue? Who can step into that place and say to a parent who just lost their child, don't be afraid, just believe? Who can say that? And let's read together from verse 53 onwards. They laughed at him, knowing that she was dead. But he took her by the hand and said, my child, get up. Her spirit returned, and at once she stood up. Then Jesus told them to give her something to eat. Parents were astonished, but he ordered them not to tell anyone what had happened. Now notice how Jesus does this. Notice how the disciples are thinking, great, this is a public spectacle. We can really use this for our PR. We can use this for our local reputation. And Jesus sends the crowds away. And not only that, but when he's done this, he orders them not to tell anybody what had happened. I don't know quite what sort of position that puts Jairus in when he's having conversations with people in the neighbourhood later on that week. You're looking a bit more upbeat than you ought to be, Jairus. I'm not quite sure how that would have worked, but nevertheless, Jesus says, I don't want this to be a PR thing. 'tis personal, but notice how domestic and how tender Jesus is. He takes her little hand in his. And the words we have in our Bibles are translated in our NIV, "My child, get up," but that's far too formal. These words, "Talitha kumi," are the words he'd have said in Aramaic. Far more affectionate and domestic than saying, "my child." It's far closer to something like "sweetie" or "honey," or a pet name someone might have for their daughter. So you can imagine Jesus who goes into that place, into that shadow, that valley of the shadow of death, takes her by the hand and says, "Hey, sweetie, it's time to get up." Different each time with Jesus, isn't it? If we think of Lazarus's death, Jesus at that point in John's Gospel is weeping furious tears. He's so angry at death. He hates it. It feels like a wrestling match. But in this instant, Jesus just steps in there, takes her by the hand and says, "Sweetie, honey, it's time to wake up." Beautiful Saviour. Who else can do that? Who else can come into that darkest place and treat death like a good nap? I just want to suggest three take-homes for us this week. The first thing I'd like to notice is that the woman who gets healed and Jairus' daughter are rescued not by the strength of their faith, but by the object of their faith. The point is not how much they believe in Jesus, but the fact that they believe in Jesus. This woman, her faith, I think, is quite weak and frightened. She doesn't really want to interact with Jesus. I think if you'd asked her that morning what she would take, I think she'd have said, "I'll just touch the back of his cloak and see how that goes." Doesn't want to look at him face to face. And yet, notice how kind and how gently Jesus deals with her. Notice how he accepts her faith. He brings it out of her and he asks her to articulate it. Now, Jairus' faith is in some ways a lot more straightforward, because if you think of how other religious leaders have been in the Bible, let's think of Nicodemus. Remember him at the beginning of John's Gospel. He comes in the middle of night. He doesn't want anybody to see that he's even talking with Jesus. And Jairus comes in broad daylight in the middle of everyone and throws himself on his feet. Unlike other teachers, Jairus doesn't set a trap for Jesus. Not trying to trick him into doing or saying something that's that they don't approve of. He just gets on his knees, and Jairus makes the choice that all of us have to make sometimes. It's really easy to debate and argue and think about the various things there are in life to believe in. But in the day-to-day trenches of life, it is not an option to live without faith. We live by believing in something. And I think if this moment of Jesus' life tells us anything, it's come as you are, come weak, come strong, come with your doubts, come with your confusion, but come to Christ. But he's kind. He knows that your faith is weak. He knows that you're flaky. He knows that you say one thing and do another, but still just come to Jesus because he's kind. Second thing, as I've already mentioned, as we've been going through this interaction, is that Jesus' timings are not the same as ours. There's an American bishop who almost has the same name as me. His name is Bishop Phillips Brooks. He wrote a Christmas carol. So often I'll get a text from a friend at Christmas saying, "Didn't know you wrote O Little Town of Bethlehem," whichever one it was. So Bishop Phillips Brooks was noted for his poise and quiet manner. And at times he suffered moments of frustration and irritability. And one day a friend saw him pacing the room like a caged lion. He said, "What's the trouble, Mr. Brooks?" And he answered, "The trouble is that I'm in a hurry, but God isn't." Haven't we all felt that way sometime or other? And the thing I think this interaction tells us as we read Luke's Gospel is that in the face of real pain and real grief, it is not enough simply to say God works in mysterious ways. God's timings are not like ours. Those words are probably quite comforting if you've just, you know, not been asked back for a second job interview or something like that. But it's hopeless if you've just buried someone you love. Just to say that becomes a thoughtless platitude, doesn't it? God works in mysterious ways. The difference between a platitude like that and real biblical spirituality is that it's personal. It's the healed woman at that moment that Jesus stops and turns around to look at her. It's Jesus looking Jairus in the eye and saying, "Trust me." Faith is not a distant view, but it's a warm embrace. It's a clinging on with all you've got. It's being able to wait, and getting better at waiting, not because you've resigned yourself to the universe being an unfair place, but because you've seen something of the beauty, the compassion, the tenderness of Jesus, and you trust him. You know that he weeps with you. And you also know that your prayers would be entirely different if you knew everything that he did. But nevertheless, the encouragement of this passage, keep going to him. Keep praying, keep asking God for those situations that you perhaps have even given up on praying for because they just feel so intractable. But let it be personal. Last of all, I just wanted to not miss the headline of this passage. C.S. Lewis once wrote that miracles are a retelling in small letters of the very same story which is written across the whole world in letters too large for some of us to see. Jesus is master over sickness and over death. Jesus doesn't come and give us a different way of thinking about death. He doesn't come and just say, think of it as freedom. You know, think of death as release or letting go. He sees death as the great enemy. As we come face to face with the great enemy in our lives or in the lives of those we love, we find various things just don't work. Jairus found in that moment that all of his good deeds, all of his respect, all of his straight living were powerless. The bleeding woman, she found that all of the money she'd spent on doctors was powerless to beat the living death that she was suffering from. As we heard in Romans 8, Mike read us this morning, that it's through Jesus' death, through him entering into death headfirst, he has set us free from the law of sin and death. He is powerful enough to reach into death, to go to a morgue, and treat it like an afternoon nap. We acknowledge that death hurts like nothing else in the meantime, but we proclaim this morning that Jesus has victory over death. And this miracle, I'd suggest, is just a couple of pixels, a tiny corner of the screen of the IMAX size spectacular that is coming our way. In a few moments we're going to enact that in a different way altogether as we come to communion. But before we do that, just a very, very simple question. Do you trust Jesus with your death? Do you trust that after you have breathed your last, that your story will only just be beginning because of Jesus? Are you ready to put your trust in him? Are you ready to wake up?